This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Thanks for listening to The Gist. If you want to check out an ad-free version and bonus content, go to subscribe.mikepesca.com. It is the best way to directly support our endeavors. Hello, it's Saturday. It's the Saturday Show. Maybe I should start these shows with a little, what? Oh, hello there. It's you. You know that conceit? Sometimes, maybe it's a Masterpiece Theater type set. Someone is reading a book in a winged chair, smoking a pipe, wearing tweed. He looks up, surprised to see the camera. Oh, I didn't know it would be you. Anyway, it's Saturday. It's the Saturday Show. We play one of the best from the week and one of the best from the vaults. From the vaults, we go back to 2019, a book called The Intelligence Trap, Why Smart People Make Dumb Mistakes by David Robson. I can't identify, but you know, I'll bring it to you guys in case you find something there that you can relate to. This is just a public service that I perform. And my one from the week, it's usually a spiel, but this was actually a segment at the top of the show. It was about the Taliban. They do have a strong brand, as I note in the show topper. You know you've done something, I'm going to say wrong, if the Westboro Baptist Church looks at your religious organization and says, ooh, those guys are freaking hardcore. Is the Taliban. So my thoughts on the latest Taliban initiative and why smart people make dumb mistakes, which probably does not apply to you, maybe me, or the Taliban.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PIE, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcast, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
This episode is brought to you by The Jordan Harbinger Show. You've heard me talk about The Jordan Harbinger Show because it's one of my favorites. He does in-depth interviews with some of the world's most fascinating minds. I can name a few: Barbara Boxer, Anderson Cooper, Michael McFaul, the Ukraine or Russia ambassador talking about Ukraine. One I recently listened to was Stanley McChrystal, the general, the former general, and he told an interesting story about revering Robert E. Lee. But then, after having a portrait of him for 40 years, he's a 63-year-old man, throwing it in the trash. Because his wife says, you know, what that picture and that man means to you, it doesn't mean to other people, and you have to understand that. And then in the interview, they got around to the point where McChrystal talked about that interview in Rolling Stone magazine that pretty much ended his career, where it got to the desk of Barack Obama, and it had McChrystal saying unflattering things about the war effort, and just how he talked to his wife and how they decided not to be bitter and not to wallow in it. He could have taken some shots at the process, the reporter, or the president at that point, but he didn't. It was just an overall good interview. It was facilitated by Jordan's excellent interview style. Whether Jordan is conducting an interview or giving advice to a listener, you will find something useful that can apply to your own life in every single episode of The Jordan Harbinger Show. That could mean learning how to ask for advice the right way or discovering a little mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. Search for The Jordan Harbinger Show. That's HAR, like the first three letters in hard, BINGE, as in how you'll want to catch up on all the episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Smart people act stupid. This is not just a fact that we all know. It's a fact we're pretty gleeful about. Witness the Gary Larson cartoon about the school for the gifted. Don't know it? Google it. Okay, I'm in the Democratic debate for a second. Anyway, smart people acting stupid, I've always thought, has an explanation that lays in the word, the two-word phrase, smart people. And it is the second word. It's that they're people, and all people are susceptible to what we would broadly call stupid thinking, which are cognitive mistakes, which are flaws in logic, but which are also failure to consider and self-reflect. Well, David Robson, in his new book, The Intelligence Trap, Why Smart People Make Dumb Mistakes, talks about this, but he goes further and he lays out areas where it might be the smartness itself that's getting in the way of the good decision. Hello, David. Thank you for coming on The Gist.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So I read the original BBC article that sparked your interest, and it was about these terribly named group of people named the termites. Who were the termites?
So these were like study participants in a study by this guy called Lewis Terman. So the name comes from his name.
Yeah.
Because over the years, it was a longitudinal study that went over decades. And, you know, he formed a very close bond with them, which is why they're called the termites. And his idea was to collect a group of people who were kind of geniuses according to this new IQ test or intelligence test. So they all had IQs higher than 135. Most of them had IQs higher than 140. And he really wanted to see just how well they performed in all areas of life, how good their health was, but also how they succeeded in
and
their
he identified
careers.
Them as young people in what decade?
That's right. So it was in the 1920s.
Right.
And they were, you know, all starting like elementary school. I think the age range was probably between like 5 and 9 or something like that.
Right. And they went and I don't know if it was normed for their status, their social status or the opportunities that they would have from economics. But it is true that most of them went on to much greater earnings than average.
Yeah, that's right. So I would say it wasn't actually very well controlled for their
economic
background.
It's 1920. What are you going to do?
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, it's very much a product of its time. And they did perform kind of better than the kind of average population, but probably not as good as you would have hoped, given that they were so-called geniuses. So, you know, a lot of them made it into the kind of who's who of America, but, you know, lots of them didn't as well. So there was always this kind of disappointment almost by the end of this study that they just hadn't quite done as well as Terman had hoped at the beginning.
Well, so a number of questions pop to mind. One is, and this is a question that you talk about and that I thought about a lot in the book, does some of the disappointment, if the reason that it's interesting is that, oh, it is a little disappointing and many of them underachieved, is that because we had too much riding on the definition of IQ or how they defined it then? Now we have a broader definition, and maybe we were narrowly defining IQ in a way that actually, when you really think about it, we wouldn't think necessarily would lead to greater success in many cases.
Yeah, I agree. So, you know, Lewis Terman had said at the time that IQ was like the one single thing that was the most important factor in anyone's life. And, you know, not just with like their kind of academic success, but he really thought it underlined creativity and morality.
Yes.
And I think really his study was one of the first to kind of show that actually that isn't true and that so many other factors are going to influence it. And some of it is just luck or personal choice. But, you know, also I think psychologists now are really looking at those other traits that are important as well as the skills we measure with IQ tests. They're also essential for success in whatever field you're trying to achieve in.
I find with so many studies in the book that the studies are the study and you have some caveats with them. But then when they extrapolate why, it's just some guess that I could have come up with quite easily. Like what you said, maybe it is because someone with a high verbal ability would be able to verbalize their feelings, but it's quite likely that it's something else. And there's no way to test that that's the explanation.
No, I mean, I would say that's a fair criticism of that study. I think, though, when you do look at the whole kind of range of research that I cover in the book, you do see this very clear picture emerging,
right,
which is that, you know, we do need to look beyond the kind of more abstract or memory skills that we've kind of cultivated and measured in education. And we have to look at these other kind of abilities. So one example that I find really interesting is this kind of, it's part of the creative intelligence that Robert Sternberg talks about, but it's the capacity for counterfactual thinking. So that's really just looking at kind of what-if scenarios. So, you know, what would have happened if Hillary Clinton had won the election? How would she have responded to world events? And that might seem, you know, you might think, well, why do we care about these fictional ideas? But actually, that's really important for problem solving, to be able to consider all the possibilities that are ahead of you. And that's something that we don't really encourage in schools, but can be taught and could be really profound in later life.
Right. And in fact, there are a lot of theories about IQ that what you're talking about there, which is a form of abstract thinking, counterfactual thinking, every societal rise in IQ, which is documented, is basically because we just think abstractly more than we ever did. That a primitive society would not have to understand imagining something other than the canoe right before them. But now everything that we do with computers and talking to people who aren't in the room, it's some form of abstract thought.
Yeah, that's right. And so actually, I would say that so this is called the Flynn effect.
Yes.
You know, we've seen this kind of 30-point increase over the last 80 years. So, you know, really substantial. Someone who is average at the time of the Terman study would be almost a genius by now. So really substantial. But I think that is a very narrow set of skills that we've really refined. And even though counterfactual thinking is a form of abstract thinking, I would say actually the abstract skills that we've kind of cultivated to produce the Flynn effect are actually even narrower than that. So that
yes.
would be much more like pattern recognition, or, you know, like recognizing kind of symbols and being able to follow kind of the rules on your smartphone, like that kind of
right.
thinking, rather than necessarily that more sophisticated way of reasoning that's considering lots of different hypotheses all at once.
We've had a 30-point rise in IQ. Have we had the concomitant decline in mistakes?
No, well, I mean, I would say absolutely not. I mean, I know thinkers like Steven Pinker have shown that we have seen some really important improvements, you know, in like a decrease in kind of certain types of crime. And obviously it has brought some scientific improvements and, you know, like reductions in infant mortality. But I would say that in other areas, we don't see any kind of reduction at all. So in politics, it's just as polarized or even more polarized than it ever was in the past. And there are still huge numbers of people who are climate change deniers or who are anti-vaxxers and who reject like the scientific consensus. And I would say that shows that the rise in IQ alone has not made people kind of wiser, more rational thinkers.
So this dogmatism, this belief in your own intelligence, would that be related to the Dunning-Kruger effect?
Yeah, that's right. So it's kind of the opposite of the Dunning-Kruger effect in a way. So the Dunning-Kruger effect is this idea that, you know, kind of stupid people or, you know, people with less knowledge in a particular area kind of overestimate their capabilities in that area. And, you know, that's been shown certainly amongst like students or, you know, when you give people kind of tests of grammar, like the people who perform worse actually think they're going to be in like the top percentile.
Yeah.
But
or as they would say, the toppest percentile.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. Whereas this actually shows that in lots of situations, experts can overestimate their expertise and kind of fail to kind of recognize the limits of the knowledge. And one reason is this phenomenon called meta forgetfulness. So that's like you don't really realize how much you've forgotten.
Right.
So, you know, I studied mathematics at Cambridge University, but now I probably have forgotten, like, you know, 90% of what I learned. But I'm kind of, having looked at this research, I'm kind of aware of that fact. But when they've questioned most graduates, they don't really realize just how much they've forgotten. They still think they have, like, that peak level of knowledge that is just continued in the decades afterwards. And so that then can lead to that earned dogmatism, because you have the perception that you're an expert, but actually you just don't know as much as you think you do.
This gets to a question I've had for a long time, because I've never been a stupid person, so I don't know how stupid people navigate the world. But it is true, your book shows, I think we all realize that maybe very smart people overestimate their abilities and say things to themselves like, well, I could do this, I'm smart, or why wouldn't I be able to get this? I'm a smart person. And it's also true that, you know, more than half the people think they're more intelligent than average. But I'm not talking about very cognitively impaired people, but are generally stupid people more apt to say, well, what would I know? I'm a stupid person. Or would they only apply that to a very technical situation? Like, I don't know about computers, but just in navigating the world, are stupid people more humble about their abilities to not make cognitive errors?
So I wouldn't say that necessarily, although there is this thing called the bias blind spot, which is important. And so that is this ability to kind of recognize if you suffer from cognitive errors. And they have shown that actually the higher your IQ, the kind of bigger your cognitive blind spot. So in a way, that does speak to what you're talking about. Now, it was quite a small effect, so it's... you know, like there's not much of a difference between people at all levels of IQ, but it still is the case that people who maybe have always just performed well in exams, they've always been told they're smart, then do just kind of assume that even with these kind of cognitive biases that people like Daniel Kahneman has studied, they just assume, well, like that doesn't apply to me.
Right. So. There are some walks of life that just the confidence in you having a trait, in fact, makes the trait come true. Like a very good-looking person or someone who thinks they're very good-looking might exude confidence and therefore be able to attract other good-looking mates, right? Mm. I think there's something like that in intelligence, which is Steve Jobs is very smart, but also he's really, really sure that he's very smart. But that certainty probably could come back to bite him, but it probably generally helped him in his career, which was based on being a smart guy in the world of business and tech.
Yeah, you're right. So, you know, I think Steve Jobs is the perfect example of this because he was a man who... Like, how can I put this? You know, he had very strong intuitions and, you know, like that kind of genius creativity. And he was so certain that he was right. And his friends kind of talked about, I can't remember what it was exactly, like this, his ability to kind of bend reality to his will in the way that you suggested, you know, and he really got his own way and succeeded so well because of that, because he often was right. But then that really backfired when he was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer.
Because
he just completely, like, wanted to turn a blind eye to it. And then he believed that he could, like, you know, if he went on this kind of pure vegetable diet or, you know, turned to kind of these quack cures, that would fix him. And actually, like, doctors really believed that if he had just had the surgery straight away, that he may well have survived. And it's like this kind of tragedy that the kind of genius that was helping him so much in his career, like, was also may have, like, knocked decades off of his life.
There's a large part of the book that talks about, I would say, some areas that seem like intelligence but are slightly different. Wisdom. Mm. And then there's even, they said of FDR, he had a second-rate intellect but a first-rate temperament. I don't know that temperament is used as a word that much these days, but there's something to that. Disposition. I don't know if this has any meaning. In the book, you talk about Aristotle's definition of wisdom, for instance. But when we say that, what do we mean, and is there something to that?
Yeah, so this was something that I guess before I wrote the book, I was quite skeptical that you could ever kind of scientifically define and test wisdom. But there has been this really fascinating research by Igor Grossman at the University of Waterloo, who's tried to come up with a more robust way of measuring what wise reasoning might be. So he looks at all of the philosophy, and then he kind of came up with these different traits that he considers to constitute wise reasoning. So the most important, I think, from my point of view, is intellectual humility. So that is just that capacity to recognize that you might not know everything straight away, that there's more information out there that might disagree with your assumptions that you need to interrogate. There's also perspective taking. So just how well can you kind of consider the different viewpoints in a situation and weigh them up? And it doesn't mean you always have to agree with everything they say, but you just have to take them into consideration and question whether actually there might be something to it. So he came up with this kind of definition, and then he puts people through these tests where they reason out loud about different problems. It could be political issues. You know, I think at the time he asked them to talk about the annexation of Crimea, for instance, or personal kind of dilemmas taken from a Dear Abby agony aunt column. And psychologists would kind of rate them on these different qualities. And then he looked at how well those scores would relate to kind of people's overall life satisfaction or health or well-being. And he found there was actually a very good correlation there. And it proved to be more predictive of someone's well-being than IQ. So it did seem to measure something important about the way they were making decisions within their life and kind of the insight they had on their own thoughts and feelings.
And as a hopeful measure, you could teach this, just like you could teach the counterfactual reasoning, and that leads to fewer mistakes.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And there are some kind of tricks that people can use, you know, that kind of have an instantaneous benefit. So one of them is It sounds a little bit odd, but it's talking to yourself in the third person. Mm-hmm. So, you know, like if I was having a problem at work, I'd start it out by saying like, oh, David is very frustrated because of this and this and this. And that is known as self-distancing because it helps you to just take a step back and stops those kind of emotional factors from ruling
your
thinking.
Except our president will say, not until Trump, he'll talk about himself.
Yeah, so exactly.
It's not always helping you.
Yeah. That does bother me, actually. But yeah, in general, like amongst normal participants, it does seem to be very effective at making people a little bit more intellectually humble, more able to look at different perspectives. And it seems to be like one very sure trick to just, in the moment, change the way you're thinking.
The Intelligence Trap, Why Smart People Make Dumb Mistakes is the book. David Robson has been my guest and is the author. Thank you, David.
Thanks. It's my pleasure.
The Taliban has not taken a side on Ben Shapiro's burning Barbies as a Barbenheimer protest. The Taliban never did get sucked into the ice bucket challenge, does not worry about teenagers getting poor body images from Instagram, and the Taliban have not changed their pronouns in their online profiles. They're still either he, him, or shut up, you don't have the right to speak. And yet, the Taliban still virtue signals. They also vice shun. The Ministry for the Propagation of Virtue and the Prevention of Vice is at it again. A week ago, they engaged in a crackdown of all of Afghanistan's beauty salons. You might think styling women's hair in a country where women can't show their hair is a low-stakes occupation, but not when the Ministry for the Propagation of Virtue and the Prevention of Vice is enforcing the rules. And now, as Sky News Australia reports,
the Taliban in Afghanistan has burned musical instruments, claiming music causes immoral corruption. Thousands of dollars worth of instruments were sent up in smoke and a bonfire after all forms of music was banned from social gatherings.
As much as they say they fathom Sharia, the Taliban does not understand the law of unintended consequences. Because with this move, banning the instruments, they are basically guaranteeing a surge in a cappella groups in Afghanistan. And is that really good for anyone? I know the Taliban puts the ban in Afghanistan, but the talent is going to find a way to sing out. Oh, the Taliban, you're one frustratingly, consistently on message institution in this crazy mixed up world. I guess you could always rely on the Taliban for being the worst. And that's it for the show. Corey Warr is the producer of The Gist, and Joel Patterson's the senior producer. We'll talk to you Monday.